This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And today we're just in front of a big holiday, and we thought, well, we'd talk about something that's fun in front of the 4th of July, like watching movies. Summer movies are usually big this time of year, really big. But of course, this year we're watching movies on TV. And that's why Madeline thought maybe we should talk about the people we love to watch in movies. And we've watched them over the years, sort of our favorite actors and actresses. And Matt, when you presented the list to me, as we remarked at the time, it looks pretty white, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's unfortunate, isn't it? Although we're going to talk about some of my favorite actors and actresses who've emerged over the years, African-American performers. But, you know, that's what we grew up with, Doug, and that's unfortunate, isn't it? I mean, think about when we went to movies and our producer, Skip Wood, we saw white male actors and white female actresses on screen. That's what Hollywood presented to us. So things have changed for the better over the years, but it necessarily gives us, you know, someone who likes old movies like me, it's going to skew that way, and that's very unfortunate. But luckily, things have caught up, and I do think with what's going on in the world right now, I think Hollywood, even though, you know, when I turn on the television set, I see all kinds of actors of color, I think it's going to be another nod to they need to go even farther with diversity, don't you think, Doug? I think it's just whether it's Academy membership, which they've already started to do, or films grounded like Harriet, you know, that are specifically about African-American heroes, this is going to force that even farther, don't you think?
I do, and I've already been noticing that a number of these animated features that have been on television for so long are having those actors who were often white just sort of give up those roles and ask for somebody of the proper ethnic background to play that voice role, if you will. So things are changing.
Yeah, like the voice actor from Family Guy, who voices Cleveland Brown, is a white actor. So that's going to change as well. But let's start, Doug, with, you know, based on what we were just talking about, let's start with two very important people who are high on my list, and that's Sidney Poitier and Denzel Washington. And I always like to say that Sidney opened the doors and Denzel kind of kicked them in because, you know, Sidney Poitier was the first, I'm sure you'd agree, Doug, the first major black superstar on film. He had lead roles. His skin color was often a subject in the movies he made. The only one I can think of where it was not a subject was the Bedford Incident, the nuclear war film with Richard Widmark. But, you know, In the Heat of the Night, Defiant Ones, Lilies of the Field. But what a magnificent performer on screen. So good opposite Rod Steiger and In the Heat of the Night. And he really opened the doors for all black performers. Now, as you know, Doug, he is somewhat of a disagreed upon figure among some quarters of the black community because he always played the nice, you know, the nice black friend.
He had that sophisticated persona.
Right. He wasn't threatening, except when he slaps that guy in the Heat of the Night, which is such a great moment. And Rod Steiger doesn't do anything to intervene in it, which is just a great scene. But I think that's been a slight criticism of him. But we have to remember he was the only one at the time. And so he got good parts, but again, you know, he opened the doors. Now, Denzel Washington, who I think is the all-time biggest African-American film star, and I want to get to a point, too, where we're just looking at actors as actors. You know, in so many of Denzel's films, his color is not an issue. Crimson Tide, Flight, it's not a big issue. Of course, in Glory, his first Oscar, it is. So great is Stephen Biko in Cry Freedom. Malcolm X, of course, Training Day, Devil in a Blue Dress. That's one of his films I really like, too. But he really is a superstar that audiences all over the world can bond with. He's an action star. He can do sensitive performances. So I really think he's taken what Poitier did, and he's taken it to another level where I think all members of the black community, the white community, whatever your ethnic background, look at Denzel Washington as an actor, just an actor, not a black actor, not a white actor, not an Asian actor. He is an actor. He's a superstar, and he is probably my all-time favorite.
And of course, on the gender side of performers of color, Cicely Tyson, Viola Davis, I know they're high on your list.
They're very high on my list. Viola Davis can do anything. She was so great in The Help and in Fences. And Taraji P. Henson, that's an actress I really like. So good in Curious Case of Benjamin Button and also in Hidden Figures. But female black performers, Doug, have even have to come farther, I think, than their male counterparts. You know, Hattie McDaniel's Oscar is so long ago, and of course she played a maid in Gone with the Wind. We've discussed that. But we're starting to see more films like Harriet, the Harriet Tubman film, geared toward lead African-American female performers. And I shouldn't say African-American because the actress who played Harriet was British. So we do get a lot of that kind of back and forth with black performers from Great Britain playing American parts like Chiwetel Ejiofor and 12 Years a Slave. But those are three of my favorites.
Well, when we look at those other actors of import over the years on your list, there are a lot of British actors among them. But let's start with Marlon Brando. He's a good old Nebraskan.
Old Omaha, Nebraska boy, yes. He's my all-time favorite, Doug. I latched on to him pretty early on as a performer, and then I started watching every movie he had ever made. And there are some bad ones in there, Doug, as you know. Countess from Hong Kong and Candy and some of those bad films he did in the 60s. But he just was different than other actors, don't you think, Doug? He was the first film star to come out of the Method, the actor's studio, where they taught the actors to behave and not overact and do theatrical acting. You know, Streetcar Named Desire made him a star on Broadway, and then he did the film version. There's really, to me, never quite been anybody like him before or since. His range was enormous. You know, he could do accent parts like in The Young Lions as the Nazi, Tea House of the August Moon, a part he would not play today, of course. He played an Okinawan interpreter. That would not fly today, of course. But he did a good job in the part, I must say. But it's the big roles on the waterfront, Godfather, Last Tango in Paris, Streetcar Named Desire that people remember. And he just had this powerful presence on screen that he was able to convey to audiences. Of course, late in his career, he got lazy. He got eccentric, hard to direct. So I think the latter part of his career, outside of a couple of performances like The Freshman and Dry White Season, wasn't quite what we wanted, but what he gave us, I think, was enough in the end.
Well, he was storied in terms of his private life, too, and sometimes that crossed over to the movies. I'm thinking of Mutiny on the Bounty, where he came away from that with a Tahitian wife.
He did.
Well, let's talk about another big name on your list, and this is a truly wonderful actor, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Wow, what can you say about him? He hasn't given us a lot, Doug. You know, he goes 5 years or so without making a movie, and then he comes back and wins another Oscar, and now he's retired. But there's nothing this man can't do. He's as close to Brando as I can find with an actor in terms of being a chameleon, commanding that screen, his commitment to the part. We've heard crazy stories, Doug, as you know, like on Gangs of New York when it was kind of cold outside, he'd walk around with a coat that someone would wear in the 1840s, like Bill the Butcher, and sure enough, he caught pneumonia. So he's in character all the time on set. Martin Scorsese has said there's really nobody like him, and DiCaprio said the same thing after working with him. But, you know, There Will Be Blood, Lincoln, I think he's the definitive Lincoln, which, you know, is amazing considering Henry Fonda and Raymond Massey became so closely identified with Lincoln that this British actor really gives us kind of maybe what Lincoln's voice sounded like. And he based that performance, Doug, on what Walt Whitman sounded like. Walt Whitman, you know, read some poetry for Edison as he got older on phonograph. And Whitman was born about the same time as Lincoln would have been kind of in, you know, in America at that time. So he kind of patterned the accent after that. So his commitment to the roles is beyond anything I think I've ever seen.
I agree with you. I remember reading the story about when he was doing My Left Foot, which was about somebody with cerebral palsy. He learned how to play a record with his foot, put the needle on a record. And in The Phantom Thread, his last film, back in 2017, and he's sort of in retirement now, I think, he actually made a gown. He actually made like a couture gown.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
He's the only actor to win 3 lead actor Oscars, so he's got that record right now, holding it steady.
Well, let's go back many years to an American classic performer, a vaudeville comedian and dancer who made it big in the movies, James Cagney.
You know, he was one of my dad's favorites. So I grew up kind of watching his movies. And again, a guy that really, is there anybody else like him, Doug? He's just so unique on screen, so powerful. That charisma was amazing. And he could do anything. He did Shakespeare. He did song and dance, Yankee Doodle Dandy. He could do comedy. He could do drama. I think of Angels with 30 Faces, that great scene at the end when Pat O'Brien asks him to play coward for the Dead End Kids because he doesn't want them idolizing him. He plays a gangster in the film, and he's going to the electric chair. And we never know, to the day Cagney died, he never revealed, did his character play chicken for the boys or was he really scared? And wow. Cagney played that scene ambiguously enough that you're just not sure. But he could do anything on screen. Just a fantastic performer, a very American performer. You know, a great guy in real life. We always heard just really nice stories about how gentlemanly he was, how kind he was to other actors. He never considered what he did art. It was just a job. And, you know, don't run into the furniture, right, Doug? Know your lines and don't pump into the furniture, which is credited either to him or Spencer Tracy. Someone said that. But there was really no one like Cagney, was there?
No, and I always remember him impersonating George M. Cohan in that big musical, Yankee Doodle Dandy, which was a lot of fun to watch.
My favorite quote about Cagney came from Orson Welles, who said, Cagney wasn't real, but he was true. He said people didn't behave in real life the way Cagney behaved on screen. It was very stylized. But yes. Wells said Cagney never had a false moment on screen. And doesn't that say it all right there?
It does. Let's talk about Julie Christie. She's on your list.
Oh, I love Julie Christie. Probably had a crush on her, probably when I was 13 or 14 and finally saw Dr. Zhivago. But
yeah.
Great range, so great in Darling, her first Oscar. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, completely against type in that film. Her later career performance in Away From Her as the Alzheimer's, the woman suffering from Alzheimer's, really she goes deep in that. Really could have been her second Oscar. She was kind of favored to win that night. But she's a great performer. Doesn't work a lot anymore, but really was a great combination of kind of that British superstar of the 60s, you know, gorgeous looking woman who also could play a variety of roles.
We're talking with Matt Olean, our resident film reviewer, about his favorite film performers, and we're going to talk about one that actually had a connection to Fargo-Moorhead, Dustin Hoffman. He directed at the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater in 1963, and I remember seeing him on stage on Broadway in a show called Jimmy Shine a long time ago, but he's been in movies, lots of movies, including that big one that made him famous.
The Graduate, yeah. And, of course, we know, Doug, that he was not the first choice to play Ben Braddock. Redford was looked at, Charles Grodin. But what an unlikely movie star. That's why I like Dustin Hoffman. He's short. He's not classically good-looking. He would tell you he doesn't look like Robert Redford. they made All the President's Men together. But what range? He goes from The Graduate to Midnight Cowboy next in his film canon. Then it's Lenny Bruce, Carl Bernstein, Kramer versus Kramer, Tootsie, what a performance there, Rain Man.
Yeah.
He remains a guy that I just can't pigeonhole. Just a fantastic range, a fantastic performer, and a really proof that there is no movie star type anymore. You can look like Dustin Hoffman, be 5'7" like Dustin Hoffman, and be a great actor.
Well, Peter O'Toole looks like an actor.
As he said in My Favorite Year, I'm not an actor, I'm a movie star. Remember that line? And O'Toole is both. He's a great actor, and he's a star. He's a movie star on screen. I still think Lawrence of Arabia is one of the four or five greatest lead performances I've ever seen on screen. He's in virtually every scene. They shot it for a year in the desert. He had to learn everything he could learn about Lawrence, and the film made him a superstar. But just a phenomenal performance. But, you know, he goes on from there. Beckett as Henry II, Lion in Winter, kind of was a hellraiser off screen, which kind of added to his legend. But I love Peter O'Toole. Again, a lot of actors I've read, actresses, loved working with him, said he was great. He was just, you know, really a generous actor, but also always kind of, they always knew they were working with a movie star. Well, let's talk about that. He looked great when he was young. He was a phenomenally good-looking man, yes.
Let's talk about a really big female movie star, Katharine Hepburn. There's a legacy.
A great legacy. I grew up watching her films with my mom. Could do heavy drama, Doug, like Long Day's Journey and Tonight, or screwball comedy like Bringing Up Baby. She's so good in Bringing Up Baby as you know, the woman who falls in love with Cary Grant, as all women did, right, on screen. They all fell in love with Cary Grant. She's so funny in that movie because she's not trying to be funny. She just kind of is how she is in that movie, saying strange things, doing strange things. So I think what I've read is, as Howard Hawks told her, who directed that film, don't try to be funny. Just act like the character and it will be funny. And she perfects that perfectly. The only actor or actress to win four acting Oscars, Lover and Lion in Winter, the Spencer Tracy films. But honestly, I think Cary Grant might have been her best co-star. You know, Philadelphia Story, Bringing Up Baby, Holiday. You talk about two strong personalities on the screen at the same time. I really love the Hepburn-Cary Grant comedies.
I love the Cary Grant transatlantic accent because that was big in the 30s and 40s. This sort of, he's British, of course, but all of these stars that were in the movies had this sort of sophisticated accent that came, that was like they were on a cruise liner somewhere between Southampton and New York.
Yep.
But he was a vaudevillian too, Cary Grant. That's how he started.
He was, and let's move right to Cary Grant. Who, and again, that accent doesn't exist anymore. Have you noticed that, Doug? People don't sound like that anymore.
They didn't then either.
Cary Grant's one of my favorites. A guy who in his lifetime was not given the accolades he should have got. He is the only leading man that I know of that looks like him and can do pratfalls, like an Arsenic and Old Lace and Bringing Up Baby. He was a circus performer, as you know, Doug, so he could do really kind of physical comedy. Phenomenally good looking. Had the dimple in the middle of his chin. We'll talk about another dimpled actor in a few minutes. I wish he would have stretched his range just a little bit. He kind of played the Cary Grant roles his whole life. But again, men liked him, women liked him. He had all the demographics covered as a film star.
I love Father Goose, which was one of his later roles. Cate Blanchett is on your list.
If there is a, I'm gonna give a nod to Cate Blanchett and say Daniel Day-Lewis is the Cate Blanchett of actors because she can do anything. She played a man in I'm Not There. Remember, she plays kind of a Bob Dylan character in that film. She has, her range has no limit. From Blue Jasmine, played Katharine Hepburn in The Aviator. That was her first Oscar. She's just a phenomenal performer. Maybe not so great at comedy, but, you know, she's played Queen Elizabeth twice. There's a film she made with Judi Dench that she's phenomenal in as well. The name is escaping me right now. It'll come to me. She's one of these performers that really doesn't, there's no type for her. She's different in every role. Carol, she's great in the movie Carol that came out in 2015 with her and Rooney Mara. That's a great performance. Again, there's nothing she can't do. She loves to work. And if there's a Cate Blanchett film, I'm there.
How about that dimpled guy you referred to, Kirk Douglas?
I always loved Kirk Douglas. He played characters that maybe weren't quite good guys or bad guys. They were sort of in between. Ace in the Hole as the reporter who kind of keeps that guy in the cave to make the story bigger. The Bad and the Beautiful as the kind of amoral film producer. But he could also play heroic men. Paths of Glory, 7 Days in May, kind of doing the right thing. Great intensity. Never won the competitive Oscar. I think he should have as Van Gogh in Lust for Life. Maybe didn't have that great later career performance that we were kind of always waiting for from him, but intensity. Kind of reminds me of Cagney, you know, just that intensity on screen that's just bursting off the screen.
Well, how about the eyes of James Mason?
I love James Mason. Very erudite, very sophisticated, could play villains, could play heroes both. So great in Lolita, the Kubrick film, as a, you know, really not a very nice person in that film. Very, very immoral person as well, but I loved his accent. He's a very imitated actor. North by Northwest with Cary Grant. He's the villain in that one. And whether he was in a small part or a big part, James Mason was always worth watching. And he was a great Brutus as well, Doug, in Julius Caesar. opposite Brando as Mark Antony.
Let's talk about another method actor, Christian Bale. I just saw him last night in a DVD of The Big Short, which is a fun movie.
Yeah, if there's anybody like Daniel Day-Lewis who's not retired, it's Christian Bale. Just think about the last 2 years, Doug. We see him as Dick Cheney in Vice, and then next we see him in Ford versus Ferrari as Ken Miles, the car driver, and he looks completely different. His weight gain for films and weight loss has been much discussed. I really hope he doesn't damage his body doing that, but there's nothing this guy can't do, that's for sure. The Big Short, The Fighter, American Hustle, he's very much has that Daniel Day-Lewis chameleon-like effect on audiences. He's from Wales, although most people think he's American. Started out as a child actor in Empire of the Sun, the Spielberg film. So this is another guy, if he's got a film out, I'm going to be there.
Frederick March, famous actor on stage and on screen.
Maybe the least best known of the nine men who've won the lead actor Oscar at least twice. Of course, Daniel Day-Lewis has won it three times. Frederick March won it twice for Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, The Best Years of Our Lives. This is another actor I got to know through my father, because my dad's favorite movie is The Best Years of Our Lives. But a great character actor. He plays Jean Valjean in Les Miserables. 7 Days in May, I mentioned that Kirk Douglas was in. He plays the president in that film. He has a great one-on-one scene with Burt Lancaster late in that movie where they go at it in the Oval Office. And just a great character actor. Maybe not a star, but that's okay, right? He was a character actor. He played Mark Twain in The Adventures of Mark Twain. Not a lot of people remember Frederick March, but he's worth checking out.
Well, let's finish with a couple of well-known British actresses, Audrey Hepburn and Glenda Jackson.
Yeah, Audrey actually is from Belgium, Doug.
Oh, that's right. She was born into royalty.
Of her as British. Yeah, I really like Audrey Hepburn. Her career didn't make a lot of movies after about 1967. But again, I think her range was underrated. You look at her in Wait Until Dark, where she plays the blind woman who's menaced by Alan Arkin and those other people that barge into her flat. That was really, I think, her last great performance. Two for the Road with Albert Finney. She's funny in that movie. War and Peace. I thought she was a very good Natasha in War and Peace. But I think The Nun Story is her best performance. That's a movie that sometimes pops up on Turner Classic. It's really, I think, the best film ever made about the religious life. It's about a young woman who joins the convent, and eventually she leaves the convent. It's a really good film directed by Fred Zinnemann. She really shows a lot of range in that movie. My Fair Lady was a little bit unfortunate that her singing got dubbed by Marnie Nixon. And Julie Andrews might have been a better Eliza Doolittle. She did it on Broadway. Charade with Cary Grant. I love Audrey Hepburn with Cary Grant in that movie. So she, again, is really a personality on screen who just pops off the screen.
Well, let's finish our discussion with Carl Reiner, who passed away. He's not on your list of all-time best actors, but what a legacy of comedy he left behind.
And really a writing legacy. You know, he really deferred to other people to be funny. You know, he was the straight man with Mel Brooks in the 2000-Year-Old Man skit. And he directed Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid with Steve Martin, quite a few Steve Martin films. So what a legacy, what a life, and we're very sad to learn of Carl Reiner's passing.
Well, he passed at the age of 98, so he had a rich life. Your show of shows, Caesar's Hour, mm-hmm. He wrote for those. Of course, the Dick Van Dyke show he was in.
Yep.
And he has his son, Rob Reiner, who continues that legacy. So lots to talk about, lots of wonderful movies and memories, Matt.
Thanks, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, Mark Trahan comments about the national debate over mascots and symbols. Sue Balcom drops by for Main Street Eats, and Eliza Blue will share another postcard from the prairie. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Parts of our region could be in for severe weather this afternoon and tonight. The National Weather Service says the threat will remain over the next several days.
We're just going to be kind of stuck in this pattern with chances for showers and thunderstorms, severe storms, very heavy rainfall, above normal temperatures, You can take the forecast for today, copy and paste it for every day over the next week, pretty much.
Meteorologist Adam Jones says today the threat is more in southwestern and central North Dakota.
Folks in the James River Valley may not see much in the way of storms today or tonight, but there's plenty more opportunities for storms coming up this weekend.
And the threats associated with tonight's round?
We're looking at pretty big hail up to golf ball size, some damaging winds up to 70 miles an hour will be possible, and then, of course, very heavy rainfall. And we've already had quite a bit of rain over the past week, many locations receiving 1, 2, 3, 4 inches of rain. So with an additional quick burst of rainfall with these thunderstorms, conditions could quickly deteriorate, and flash flooding is a concern as we go through today, but especially this weekend.
The city of Emerado is in recovery mode after at least 8 inches of rain on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning produced overland flooding affecting homes and roads. Emerado Police Chief Dan Lund says the water has receded, but there is a long way to go.
Even the Dollar General site that they have building right now, you can see where the water was up on the dirt mound has gone down, between a foot and 18 inches. So it's better. Now it's just going to be a matter of getting things cleaned up.
Lund says basement cleanup kits are available today at City Hall. Lund also said the Emerado Fire Station is cleaning up after taking on some water yesterday. And a direct descendant of Louise Agassiz says if members of the community want to remove her ancestor's name from various landmarks, she would support them. Last week, the Metropolitan Council of Governments said the Agassiz Greenway's name will be dropped because of Agassiz's racist viewpoints. Marion Moore of Minneapolis is Agassiz's great-great-great-granddaughter.
It's more important to me that these ideas that he advanced are shown to be wrong and also to have contributed to where we are today in the inequity and the stupidity of the separation of races. And if I have to let go of part of the myth of my own sort of specialness, that's part of the work. That's part of what needs to happen.
Moore says removing her famous ancestor's name is not a very big sacrifice to help recognize what Agassiz was part of. Prehistoric Lake Agassiz was named after the 19th century geologist. The name is still on the building that houses Woodrow Wilson High School and the former Agassiz Middle School in Fargo. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant taught journalism at the University of North Dakota before becoming the editor of the online publication Indian Country Today. Mark is a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, and today his commentary focuses on a long simmering issue for America's diverse cultures.
So much has happened in just the past few weeks. The death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police officers changed everything. Debates about symbols that had gone through the slow process with meetings before boards, city councils, even legislatures, and then nothing. Then, after the nation saw firsthand the injustice of George Floyd and so many others like him, that bureaucratic patience expired. People wanted action. It's even hard to keep up with the news because it's happening so fast. Just in the past few days, President Donald Trump, who does not favor changing the story at all, has called for new federal law enforcement powers to protect monuments and statues. He practically looks out his window at Andrew Jackson, one of those statues that almost came down. On Saturday, 4 men were charged with felonies in connection with that act. But the president is in the minority. The Mississippi legislature over the weekend said it's time to retire the Confederate battle flag from the state flag. And in Orange County, California, there is a new call to rename the airport and remove a statue of its namesake, the actor John Wayne. In the movies, Wayne was often the cowboy Indian killer. In real life, he was public about his racism. He told Playboy he believed in white supremacy and said it was not wrong to take this great country away from Indians. Wayne said there were a great number of people who needed new land, and the Indians selfishly were trying to keep it for themselves. What's in a name? How about the inevitable name change for the Washington NFL team? The owners removed a statue to the team's founder, George Preston Marshall. He was the last NFL owner to integrate his team, and he did so only because he was forced to in 1962. Last week, a coalition of business sponsors, including Nike and Pepsi, made the case for changing the Washington team name. According to Marketing Daily, sponsorship and spending on the NFL and its 32 teams exceeded $1.47 billion last season. That's why the name change is a when, not an if. So how do these actions change the story of America? We have a draft right in front of us. It's up to all of us to write new chapters that reflect a national story that includes everybody. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Main Street Eats is next.
African Soul American Heart protects orphan girls from South Sudan from forced marriage by keeping them in school until they're adults and able to make their own choices about their futures. Learn more at ASAHinSudan.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Sue Balcom. It's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Happy 4th of July coming right up here.
Holy cow, can you believe it? It's been like, seems like spring and March and all that has lasted for so long. It's about time we went outside and party, don't you think?
I agree.
Yeah, but before you can party, you have to remember that your garden needs a little bit of attention. Hmm. Whether you do this like my relatives did or not, but I thought it would be kind of fun to talk about the correlation between the 4th of July and potato bugs, mostly because a lot of people have canceled their 4th of July reservations in other states and other theme parks and are kind of staying at home. So we're going to talk a little bit about family 4th of Julys that they used to have back in the days when my mom was young. And it was so funny to me because all of these people that I interviewed for the Germans from Russia projects I did, remember this about the 4th of July. Nobody went anywhere until they went out and hoed the potato patch. Chores first. And so one of the things that occurs about the, you know, beginning of July is that potato bugs will show up on your potato plants. And I remember one, you know, we're always looking for organic ways to eliminate pests from our garden. And I had one gal tell me that their mom used to sprinkle flour on their cabbages and potatoes and that took care of these bugs and moths and things like that. And I'm like, wow, that's incredible. Who'd have thunk it? Well, what she didn't know as a child was that there was probably Paris green mixed in there. And that was just its delivery method. And Paris green, which sounds lovely, is actually quite toxic. And I don't think that you could really buy it anymore. It was first used against the potato beetle back in the 1860s, and it was innovative, and it was first used with a hand-operated compression sprayer and traction-operated dusters. In fact, it was probably the first, potatoes were probably the first crop to be treated by airplane dusters with this very toxic Paris green chemical.
So, I looked it up, and Paris green got its name because it was used to kill the rats in the sewers of Paris. and interestingly enough, it was also used to make a pigment for painters back then.
Oh, so that's maybe where the green came in, because it's not a quote-unquote green chemical, as we would call a green treatment nowadays, you know, with organic and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
That would explain why so many artists from back then were a little nuts.
Died.
Did Van Gogh use Paris green?
Maybe. He did his best work in France.
Oh, shoot. That is funny. I should research that. You know, Van Gogh and I share the same birthday, so I've done a lot of reading.
Well, you've got one more ear than he did, yeah.
Right, I do. So so many of the Depression area farmers then, after the 1860s, you know, they used this for years, and then during the 30s, I suppose they couldn't either acquire it or they didn't have the money for it. But people like, I interviewed this family, the Vetter family from Linton, which Benjamin Vetter in particular, and they have this huge family down there. And he said that they used to have to, as kids, go and pick the bugs off the potato plants, and they would throw them in a bucket of kerosene because you had to kill them. Otherwise, they'd crawl out and get back on the potato plants. So picture that. We're going to the 4th of July parade, but not till you go out there with a bucket of kerosene and pick some bugs off those potato plants.
A good idea to have kids covered in kerosene and then lighting fireworks. I can't imagine that there would be any consequences from that.
That, you know, yeah, those little ones that they held with their fingertips, no less. Right?
Well, we're not using Paris green for this anymore, or even probably much kerosene.
Right. So what you could do instead is use soapy water. You know, a lot of these bugs, insects, ladybugs, and those little awful ones that show up in the fall, they have waxy coating on them. And so if you throw them in buckets of soapy water, that breaks down their ectoskeleton, and that's how they die. So don't use the kerosene if you're going to send your kids out there. Use a little soapy water instead. But there was also hoeing to be done, and nobody, Ben Vetter's wife, Delphine, said that nobody was allowed to go to the 4th of July until they had that hoeing done. And you know that picking potatoes and planting potatoes back then was survival. So it wasn't like two or three rows. It was a field of potatoes. And some of these families, of course, would have to milk before they'd go to 4th of July. And there wasn't like a lot of stuff going on. Like they actually canceled the Mandan 4th of July parade this year. And that's a huge, huge event. So the parades of that, those days back then were basically some, you know, if somebody had a brand new car and they're driving in the parade, maybe a tractor or two. And these families would pack up a picnic lunch and they would go to town and they would just spend some time in there. I don't know how many fireworks, actual organized fireworks celebrations there were, but I do remember going to Eureka, South Dakota with my parents once, and there was a lake down there and the fireworks that were on the other side of the lake, and it was an amazing thing just to see. You know, they weren't as prevalent as they are nowadays. Like, we got fireworks stands popping up all over the place.
Well, when I was a kid, South Dakota was where you went to get the fireworks, the big stuff.
The big stuff. Well, you're right, because the other, those little ones on a string, remember they're strung together,
lady fingers.
Tiny little lady fingers. I think you could buy those at the grocery store, couldn't you?
Well, you could get sparklers and things like that. But if you wanted a silver salute or a cherry bomb, you went to South Dakota.
Well, at the risk of making this Main Street Eats thing be about potatoes instead of fireworks, there are ideas. Okay, besides picking them up and putting them in water, are there things that we can do that can kind of prevent the infestation of potato bugs?
Well, you know, I believe that I don't have them at my house because we have pheasants and turkeys. Oh. So chickens.
They like the bugs.
Yes, geese, birds. So, you know, ladybugs. Ladybugs are a natural predator to a lot of things in your garden. And also it's possible, like I do high tunnel production, and you can use a parasitic wasp that you buy. You actually purchase these wasps and let them loose. And they'll go around and they'll kill these things. And then, of course, one other thing you can do is by mulching your soil with straw or bark or compost, that kind of like repels that beetle. They must come up from the soil up. Another thing that's worked that I've mentioned before is diversification and definitely crop rotation. Potatoes and tomatoes belong to the same family. So when you're rotating crops, you never want to plant tomatoes where you had potatoes. So there are lots and lots of diagrams and little things to help you remember which crops should follow other crops. So you want to do that.
Well, when remember the Irish potato famine too. You want to diversify so that you don't have a particular potato that goes away and nobody has anything to eat. So, are there potatoes that are particularly tough on potato bugs? I mean, are they resistant to them? Is there a variety?
Yes, there was one, and it was it King Harry or yes, King Harry potatoes actually have these leafy hairs on them, and apparently those bugs don't like to walk up those stalks when they have to, you know, any kind of insect will go for the easiest food available.
Me too.
You know, they the less harder they have to work, the better. So you can plant these, but definitely there's a lot of intercropping methods that you can use. That's really huge. That diversification in all kinds of fields is really a good thing to confuse bugs. And then there is, because I don't like using chemicals on my garden, there is something called BT, which is Bacillus thuringiensis, which is naturally occurring in your soil, but you can also purchase it and mix it with water in a sprayer. And I use that on my cabbages, and I've already started spraying my cabbages, but that will starve, it paralyzes potato bug guts, and it will starve them.
Oh.
And there might be a specific BT that you buy just for potato bugs. But yeah, they're no less a Colorado potato bug. So maybe we can blame them for infesting our, I don't know if they come in on the wind or what. And
so when do we harvest potatoes?
New potatoes right after they bloom. You know, they'll grow up, they'll bloom, and then the blossoms will die off. And then what you want to do is you want to rob them a little bit, you know, by sticking your hand in there and pulling the little ones out, and you can eat those new potatoes, and they will still continue to grow potatoes. I usually don't harvest mine until well after the first frost, because the ground is sort of like a storage area for them. The plants will dry off completely and die. And you don't want to pull them out of your garden, because then you won't be able to remember where your potatoes are buried. So keep them in there until you get those potatoes out of there. And one of the things that will help production would be, like now or a couple weeks ago, maybe even, it would have been a good idea to hill them, which means you go through the rows and you pile up dirt as high around them as you possibly can. And then that increases the tuber area of your potato plant, and then you'll get more potatoes. And I'm sure you've seen those things for where you, like, you take a tire and you fill it with soil, plant a potato in there, and then you put another one on top and more soil. And
we are doing that with the wood box this year.
Cool.
Yeah,
a tower of potatoes.
Yeah,
I'll love
keep
potatoes.
You posted.
All right, good deal.
We check in with Sue Balcom for Main Street Eats every week. It's always a pleasure, Sue.
Thank you, guys.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
The pandemic has changed so many aspects of our lives, how we work, eat, play, and hang out with people.
I don't think I'm going to go back to handshaking.
And I'm not going to be flying off to conferences.
I'm Mike and Scott. Join me for The Pulse, when we'll talk about which of these changes might stick.
My lunchtime walk or workout.
I really like telehealth, and I hope that telehealth continues.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Eliza Blue is a South Dakota writer and musician. In addition to a weekly column that appears in several print publications, Eliza also produces a radio feature she calls Postcards from the Prairie. Today's postcard is about her son's love for a particularly unattractive farm animal.
2 springs ago, we went to the farm supply store during chick season, and my son, then 2 and a half, heard the chirps from the tubs of baby chicks the moment we walked through the door. Within seconds, he was leaned over the nearest tub, ready to adopt the contents. We left the store that day with a sack of seed potatoes, a garden hose, and a tiny box holding 3 new friends. The spring supply run went just about the same the following year, with one key difference. That first year, one of the tubs of chicks had been a variety called turkins, a breed of chicken that looks like a miniature turkey. They are long-legged and long-necked, and though they sport a tuft of feathers on the crowns of their heads, from their shoulders up is pink, wrinkly skin. To call them unattractive would be an understatement. When my son spotted them, however, it was love at first sight. I had managed to dissuade him from adopting one then, but in the intervening year, he'd brought up turkins more times than I could count. Which is why, when we arrived at the farm supply store the second year, and there was once again a tub of turkins, there was no chance one wasn't coming home with us. My boy named his chick Turkin Spot. White with flecks of black and a neck so naked and rubbery he looked half plucked, the wee creature was too ugly even to be considered so ugly it's cute. In fact, Turkin Spot looked more like a newly hatched dinosaur than a chicken or even a turkey. But my boy was smitten. And in retrospect, that may have been part of the appeal. Well, another spring has come and gone since then. We did not get new chicks this year as our coop is overflowing. Meanwhile, Turkin Spot has grown up. His looks, however, have not improved. Without the softness of his baby fluff, his appearance is even more off-putting. And he's kind of a jerk. Harassing the hens, running around the corral stealing grain from the lambs and bottle calves, he is the least favorite of many members of our multi-species community. None of this has lessened my son's affection for him, however, and if asked, Turkin Spot would top of his all-time favorite things. Last week represented my son's fifth circle around the sun, and in addition to the usual parade of candles and cake and gifts, he received an unexpected birthday gift. Despite our daily efforts to collect all eggs and uncover secret nests lest we end up with yet more chickens, one of our hens managed to lay and hatch out a nest of babies in the tall grass of the windbreak. She appeared this afternoon with 12, that's right, 12 in tow. And the real kicker of it all? Every last one has the long, featherless neck and spotted cap of their wayward father. Needless to say, my son decided this is the best birthday present ever. And though the last thing I personally want or need is a dozen more turkins, I'm not sad. Our prettily plumed flock will now more closely resemble a miniature herd of prehistoric creatures. But as the march of time makes ever clearer, these simple pleasures are the beautiful colors that will brighten the sepia photographs of our memories in years to come.
After being an urbanite most of her life, Eliza now resides with her sweetheart and their two children in Perkins County, South Dakota, herding sheep and raising chickens. To hear her music or find out where she will be performing, visit ElizaBlueMusic.com. Next on Main Street, Dakota Date Book.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
I'm Dave Isay of StoryCorps. For years, we've brought loved ones face-to-face for interviews about the things that matter most. Now, in response to COVID-19, we're working with public radio stations nationwide to bring you together in a whole new way. It's called StoryCorps Connect, an online tool that lets you record interviews remotely and become part of American history at the Library of Congress. Learn how at StoryCorpsConnect.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 2nd. After 10 years playing at the Trianon Ballroom in Chicago, Lawrence Welk, native of Strasburg, North Dakota, realized that his days in the Windy City were drawing to a close. The big band craze of the 1930s and 40s was ending. Welk's crowds were dwindling, and the Trianon's manager had refused repeated requests from the band for salary increases. And so, in 1950, Welk decided to pack up his orchestra and go on tour. Midway through the tour, Sam Lutz, the band's manager, secured Welk his first big break. Lutz contacted KTLA, a Los Angeles television station, about airing Welk's orchestra. The station manager was hesitant, having been burned by bands before. He finally agreed, but there was a catch. KTLA refused to pay any expenses and even asked that Welk put up $300 to pay for shooting costs. Welk agreed, and his orchestra made its television debut on May 2nd of 1951. Fortunately, Welk's on-air appearance was a complete success. The next morning, while playing golf, he received many compliments and congratulations from complete strangers who had seen him on their television sets the night before. As for KTLA, it received numerous calls and letters asking to see more of Lawrence Welk. The station manager quickly informed Welk that he'd be happy to air his band the following week and would even pay the band for its trouble. The Lawrence Welk Show grew into a successful weekly program in Los Angeles, attracting the interest of the Dodge Motor Company, which was looking for a local show to sponsor. The company sent a representative to discuss a sponsorship, but Welk rebuffed the overture, informing the Dodge agent that he was currently sponsored by Chevrolet. To this, the Dodge employee simply replied, "Oh, I think we just may get you in a Dodge one of these days." 1 month later, the Dodge Motor Company and Mr. Welk signed an agreement giving Dodge exclusive sponsoring rights. As the months passed, Welk's show became even more successful. His ratings were high, and local Los Angeles Dodge dealerships were enjoying increased business. Welk's success encouraged Dodge to reconsider its arrangement. Instead of appearing only on local television, Dodge offered Welk a national show. ABC snatched up the program, and on this date, in 1955, the first national broadcast of the Lawrence Welk Show aired coast to coast. After 27 years on national TV, Welk retired, but the show lives on, with reruns becoming one of the most popular programs on PBS. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Lane Sunwall. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Some people do not wait for the 4th of July to set off their own fireworks.
Because I go to bed hearing it, I get woken up hearing it.
In parts of New York City, residents are reluctant to ask the police for help.
I have this terrible feeling that there will be cops who would say, it's like, oh, you wanted to fund the police? Well, you deal with this problem.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. And just a reminder that as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, 100 years after the passage of the 19th Amendment, The Vote tells the dramatic story of the hard-fought campaign waged by women for the right to vote, which resulted in the largest expansion of voting rights in U.S. history. The Vote premieres next week on the PBS series The American Experience. Ashley Thornburg visits with Michelle Ferrari, the writer, director, and producer. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.